Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, January 13th. Currently 24 degrees here under partly cloudy skies and 17 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center. Waiting for that call in from Cedric Haynes, but doesn't look like he made it in this morning. So I'll tell you that we're looking for sunshine today, a high of 44, clear tonight, 29 is our overnight low, sunny and 47 on Wednesday, 45 on Thursday and Friday and Saturday. Luckily, the overnight lows are dipping below freezing, so that's helping to preserve the snowpack at least overnight, but that bright sunshine during the day, certainly not doing us any favors. And as I mentioned, 17 degrees in the Heber Valley with widespread haze through Friday. Temperatures today, 48, 20 is the overnight low. We've got 51 for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Saturday also 51, but looks like some of that haze is breaking up by Friday night. Right now on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Bo. Good morning, Bo.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, let's tell us a little bit about yourself. You're also a new forecaster.
I am. Yeah, I'm new forecaster at the Avalanche Center. I'm not new to the area. I've lived out here since 2009 and in Park City since 2018.
Oh, wonderful. Well, great. Glad to have a local guy here doing the report. So what can you tell us?
Yeah, well, you know, we're sitting in high pressure right now, so we're happy to see some sunny skies, but I think we all wish we had some snow. The conditions in the mountains are still preserved powder on shady slopes, which we like to see. So we have mostly a low avalanche hazard right now in most aspects, most slopes. The only place you could really get into trouble is high elevation slopes that are steep and rocky, windswept. I'm thinking high alpine, you know, terrain up in the upper Cottonwoods kind of thing. Those are the places where we've got a lingering, persistent, weak layer near the ground that's below our Christmas rain crust. And we've seen 4 to 5 to 6 feet of snow since Christmas. And there's this potential for people to find a thinner area that's shallow where their body weight could affect that weak layer, collapse the slope, and produce a large avalanche. Now, we're not thinking these avalanches are really likely to be triggered right now, but we've seen some signs over the last few days that ski areas are able to use explosives to cause these avalanches. So we're warning people to just be cautious, investigate the snow depths as you're traveling around the mountains. And if you find a place that's notably thinner, or if you hike around in the summertime and you know it's a boulder field, those are the places that we're telling people to just exercise some additional caution, remind people to travel in a way that's safe. So one person on a slope at a time, you're giving yourself added margin. So if your assessment is wrong, you're not gonna be caught and buried in the avalanche. We've got 7 days or so of high pressure before we see our next snowfall. So the trend is gonna be to increased stability. We may go to low avalanche hazard in the coming days. But as always, conditions are going to evolve and people can stay up to date by either visiting our website, utahavalanchecenter.org, following us on social media, or just give us a call or listen in here on KPCW each morning.
Okay. Thanks so much, Bo. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Hey, and also the Avalanche Center noted in one of its special announcements that... And this comes from Park City Ski Patrol. To those touring parties in Big Cottonwood Canyon, now that Jupiter is open, Pinecone Ridge off Puke Hill is inbounds and closed terrain. So be careful out there. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on KPCW this morning on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow's county council meeting. From the South Summit School District, Superintendent of Schools Greg Mon calling in with details on last night's school board meeting, as well as an update on that measles case. And from the People's Health Clinic, I have CEO Mari Lining, along with Patient Access Director Patty Garcia. Joining me now in the studio, the Summit County Council meeting in work session tomorrow starting at 4:30 at the Summit County Courthouse in Colville. And in the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. Let's see. We've got an hour-long property acquisition closed session, and I know you can't talk about this, but I'm guessing. I mean, is this the final one before we close on the 910 Ranch?
It might be. It actually isn't about that at all, but it might be the final one before we do close on the ranch. Things are looking very positive here, and we have a tentative date scheduled here in the end of the month, so we're hoping that we'll go through. Still feel like things are moving around, and that grant, of course, is the big part of that closing.
Ooh, tell me about the tentative date.
I believe it's the 22nd, which is a week from tomorrow.
Okay, and do you actually just go to like a title company?
That's
just
correct.
Like any other
yep.
closure?
Yep, and so we've marked out a couple of dates actually just to see. We're just waiting for those funds to actually be in the title company's hands. Then we'll probably know.
Okay, and then when you talk about property acquisition, I mean, do we have more money in the bond to buy more property?
Absolutely. I think one of the most exciting things about the 910 for me is it was a $55 million acquisition that only $15 million, 1.5, of the bond funds came from actually Summit County coffers. So we still have, it's always changing. We're always acquiring and assisting with other acquisitions as well. But I still think we're well into the almost $20 million of available funds. We spent five on the Your Ranch acquisition that did close, and we spent another, I think, $10 million from transient room taxes, so we're moving from others as well. It's just a group effort here with the other land conservation outfits, so it's very exciting.
So for those of us paying property taxes, are we going to start to see bond repayment happening on our tax bills this year in November?
I actually don't know how that works because the bonds were pulled back in, you know, years ago. And in fact, we were concerned about arbitrage with some of the incredible interest rates we were receiving. But that should be still on your taxes like it was when, was it 2019 when the bond was pulled?
Yeah, again, and that's part of the meeting later, discussion and possible approval for a resolution that authorizes not more than $99 million of revenue bonds. The council passed the bond parameters last year, so what are they voting for on Wednesday? I mean, it just seems so drawn out.
It really does. This is the supposedly the quote-unquote final step in this. It's called the preliminary official statement, or the POS, and that is should be the final step in that 1.1%. Up to $99 million of bonds. The bonds would, I think it's the last step before a bond sale, and we would do that probably in the next 2 weeks.
Okay, and again, this is paying for Your Ranch?
Sorry, no. That actually bond is for that impacted communities tax or resort communities tax that was set aside for transportation and transit. So that's what that one's for, just after 5 p.m. on Wednesday. So that if you remember, that the council implemented that sales tax last year, 1.1%. It's only in the unincorporated areas of the county, and it's set aside for transportation and transit. It's going to go towards BRT, other projects like that. So this is the end of that. The action, hopefully, on the bond for open spaces is absolutely complete.
Okay. So, again, that's not going to be a county-wide tax then, huh? That $99 million gets paid by for just the people in the Snyderville Basin?
Yes, and that is because Park City is one of the communities in Utah that already implemented the resort communities tax, so they already have that 1.6% on their sales tax in the city. So it's everywhere, and it's outside the municipal boundaries, so it's only in the unincorporated parts of the basin and the county.
So why do you need to pull all of it out at once?
We did debate that. In fact, I thought we actually decided at the beginning that we probably wouldn't do that. But I think that the rates have gone really favorable, even since we've done our last offering, even last year. So rates have ticked down. It had some really favorable. We went and got our bond rating, and we don't even have that back yet. But we're confident we're going to have a very positive rating, and that will result in a very low rate for us. So we're thinking the rates are so advantageous, we ought to do it all right now.
What's a low rate?
I think it's What, sorry?
In your mind, what's a low rate?
Just under 4, I'm hoping, so.
All right. Let's see, during work session, backtracking a bit here, the council will be presented with payment in lieu of taxes or a PILT check. How much are we talking about?
It's just over $6,000. The DWR does like to come every year. They've done that every year since I've been here and just present that tax to us and really highlight that they're paying something. Obviously, those the state DWR, churches, schools, all do not pay property taxes, yet they still have land in our county. It has an impact. There's roads and wildfire and not those kinds of things. So this is a payment in lieu of those taxes that they don't pay, and I think they really want to make sure that that the residents know that they're doing that.
Okay. I don't think anybody else does that.
No, the federal government does that as well. We don't have much federal land in Summit County, but there are counties where the federal government will do that. But it's pennies on the dollar for what we would have received from actual property taxes.
All right. Now, during the regular meeting, the council could possibly adopt some amendments to the Park City Fire District's personnel policy. Can you just kind of let us know to do what?
It's two pretty minor things. One addresses facial hair, and they don't allow beards. And I actually was asked about this, and it's around safety. It's a lot around what they wear on their heads. So it's not just them being more restrictive than they need to be. It is a safety issue. And the other item that was highlighted in the packet was they're asking all their employees when they have an interaction with police, whether they have an arrest or even a ticket, they ask them to let them know. And I think in the past there's been some concern with that, and they want to know what's going on there. So
sure. Let's see. Later the council will discuss and possibly approve a resolution that recommits and expands Summit County sustainability and climate change action goals. So did this winter's meager snowfall have anything to do with this recommittal?
It was in progress before that, but it sure does highlight what we're trying to do here. Kudos to our sustainability team. This is a very thoughtful, updated resolution on our climate goals. And they've updated the storyline in the resolution to reaffirm that we believe climate change is real, that action is important, that the biggest impact on climate change in our community is with transportation and energy. The biggest impact from the county is in our waste services. So there's a nod to the Olympics. So it hadn't been updated since 2019, and this is the sustainability team's effort to update that. If you look at the goals side, I think they added 4 goals around water, waste, public lands. So there's some nod to some of the changes that have happened in our county over the last few years, but it's very well done. If you get a chance to read it, it's 11 goals, and then there's a commitment in there to review this every 3 years.
All right, so we don't wait so long.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, what budgetary impact, if any, will these additional 4 goals have on county operations?
Well, it's hard to say because, for example, we had a goal before to get our fleet 50% electric vehicle by a certain date. I think it was 2020, and we didn't do that. We weren't able to do that, and that was part of just the changing dynamics of fleets and the makeup. But we do have a goal to look at EV and hybrid vehicles first. So we're going to always do that. So it's hard to say that it's this impact. I think one of the exciting things to me about this sustainability plan is it doesn't say here's all the things we need to do in just one plan. It actually makes a nod to the general plan and says, okay, in the general plan we need to do things this way, and in our solid waste master plan. It takes a sustainable view in those plans that we're doing anyway, and that's, I really like that. It's almost like a little piece of all the different departments. It really is a nod to the whole county. We have to do this together, and each department is important in that.
Later, a possible adoption of a proclamation declaring January 27th as Help America Vote Day. So what's happening then?
Our county clerk, Eve First, has brought this to us. I think this is an opportunity to highlight how important it is to vote, number one, and number two, how important it is to volunteer. We can't produce these safe and fair and elections without without volunteers. And she calls out two couples, Renata and Gary Dalton and Linda and Rich Dolan. And without the Dolans and the Daltons, we can't do these elections the way we do them. So I think it's an opportunity to be specific about two couples that have really brought a lot to our elections, and then just highlight how important it is that people volunteer.
All right. Council will also get an update on the bike share end of year report. Best year ever here?
It really was. I mean, we've done more and more. It was a full 6 months of ridership. We put in three new stations. We actually relocated the bike share to a facility that we own now that we're just able to make a payment on just through the bike share. 24,000 rides. We're expanding partnerships with others. If you looked at that report, we put in the Slopeside station maybe 2 years ago, and it's the number two most used. So we're trying to look at the community and see where ridership might be that high through housing projects and through employers and through social services, and really like to see the bike share be something that's utilized for transportation, not just for recreation.
Yeah, and I think that was the original intent, is to try and get more cars off the road. Do we have any way to measure that?
I haven't really seen how that's measured, and that's a great question for our transportation division, because like the Slopeside one, for example, just in my conversations with our transportation department, they have mentioned that is well utilized for transportation, that a lot of those in Slopeside, and when I say Slopeside, that's in the canyons for those that don't know, and it's mostly a lot of J-1 visa holders, it's a lot of those that work seasonally at the resort that may not have vehicles, and a lot of them use those to get around, especially socially. That's used a lot at night, might be used when people have had a couple of drinks somewhere, which is probably not a safe thing to do, but I think it is utilized a lot in the evenings. So I think that one's been used a lot for transportation, and we'd really like to ramp that up.
Yeah, you also had a pilot program in Colville. So what kind of response did you see, and will it be expanded?
It will, and it was really well utilized. It was only available to county employees, and it's right there at the county courthouse. And so it'll be interesting to see if we expand that outside of county employees, if that's used in the community much or not. But it was very well utilized by county employees, and a lot of people took that as an opportunity to just get out for a lunch and bike around and clear their head, and I think that was well utilized, and kudos to Carl and his team for that.
Okay. Let's see, the county also purchased a warehouse to store the bikes and the equipment. So how much did that cost?
I think it was in the Home Depot area, and I want to say it was $800,000 for the warehouse and all the office space, but I don't quote me on that exact number. I think it was about that.
And the idea is that will actually save the county money over the long haul, and as opposed to just kind of leasing.
That's right. We're paying less for that payment to back to the county. So bike share we're trying to operate that as an independent quasi business. It is paying that back to the county in that purchase, and they're paying less per month just to purchase that from the county than they were in just leasing office space from a private individual.
Mm-hmm. And it showed, the report showed more than 69,000 miles on the bikes this past year. How's the equipment holding up?
Good. We have three full-time folks that manage, you know, where those are. They store them for the winter. If you go into where they were renting before, it was just bikes hanging everywhere. It's like a full-time operation, just keeping those bikes operational. And of course, we're cycling through and buying new bikes all the time too, and doing that within the funds and the parameters and the budget. So yeah, it's going really well.
Yeah, so with equipment, staff, warehousing, is the county breaking even? Or, I mean, is this a moneymaker for the county? Or
It hasn't been a moneymaker, and mostly that's because of the fact that any time we've brought funds in, we have utilized them to buy more bikes and to try and expand stations and that kind of thing. But I think with these additional partners, if you read that report, it talks about they'd really like to expand partnerships, and I think that's a really good next step. We've kind of established that we are going to be doing this for, in the years to come. And I think having some of those additional partnerships will just ramp up. And look, we're not trying to make money with this. That's not my intention, at least. Mm-hmm. Council can obviously disagree with that, but I would like to just to see it be as affordable, especially to our residents, as possible.
So is it considered an enterprise fund and that it's...
I don't think it's actually exactly that. That's how I treat it. That's exactly how I treat it as an enterprise fund. The funds go into there and the funds go out of there, and we want to know exactly what that quasi-business is costing the county.
All right. Any updates with the naming of the Skull Candy building? Again, we've got the residents have three choices: Cirque, the Hub, Peak Center.
Yes.
Anyone leading?
I haven't seen the results yet. We do encourage people to still vote. This is open to the public. You can get it on our website. I think we're open until the end of day on January 16th. So please do vote. Really excited to start calling that building by its new name. We'll do that very quickly.
All right. As we've reported, of course, a single measles case reported in the South Summit School District. Anything the county council needs to be concerned about of this, or are you just letting the health department take the lead on this?
Yeah, I think the health department's taking the lead. Obviously, it's important for the school district to be as involved as anyone else. Dr. Phil Bondurant let us know that this was happening over the weekend. He updated myself and the council and Jana Young, and that's important. It's important that they know. It's important that they be able to answer those questions, but I don't know what else they can do. It's in good hands. I think all the protocols were followed. It's not a great situation, but I think it was handled very appropriately.
All right. Anything else, Shane, you can update us on?
We do have applications available for our planning labs. Those are open until February 1st. This is a great opportunity for the residents of the community to interact with our planning staff, learn what planning is. It's a really great training ground for planning commissions. If anyone has interest in planning commissions, this is a great place to start. So we hope we get a lot of applications for that. And then I think KPCW reported that we have a short-term rental hotline that folks can use for concerns. This is not, it's starting on January 16th, and it's you can go to our website and you can submit concerns. There's a hotline. I can give you that number if that's helpful now, but it's 435-615-3924, and that'll be available starting January 16th for those that are concerned about activities in and around their neighborhoods with short-term rentals. We're excited to do more on that front.
Okay. Hey, Shane, thanks for coming in.
Happy 2026.
Thanks,
Leslie.
You too. That's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. The South Summit Board of Education met last night, and on the phone with a recap of the meeting, I have the Superintendent of Schools, Greg Mullen. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much. Well,
good.
Let's jump right into the issue of how the district is being impacted by a single case of measles that surfaced January 5th. Are you aware of any more cases at this point?
No, we're not aware of any more.
Okay, and how's the student doing? Will they be okay?
Well, I think, if you've had or if you know anyone who's ever had measles, it's a pretty miserable illness. Generally not life or death, but certainly feels like it could be. So, from what I hear, the student's doing okay, just going through all of the different stages of the measles.
Okay. Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant told us yesterday that 20 or so students and staff who were not vaccinated are now being quarantined. Can you break that down for us? I mean, how many staff members are impacted?
Well, I want to back up just a little bit from there, at least, just to say, we actually started planning for this potential with the health department clear back in the summer. All three districts in Summit County and the health department, we started meeting about it in the summertime to prepare. And so I feel very fortunate that our team, we've been able to communicate with parents and staff clear back as early as the end of summertime. And so thankfully, because of that, we were able to start getting documents, as far as people's immunization documentation and things, which really helped because the number would have been a lot higher than what it was. So my understanding is we had a few teachers, parapros, just staff, and then 20-ish students. And some of those, you know, obviously if they have records of immunization, they can bring those in and they come back to school.
All right. So, I mean, I don't understand why it could have been a lot higher if you didn't have the vaccination records.
Could have, the number out could have been higher simply because a lot of, especially adults, like me, for example, I don't necessarily know right where my immunization records were. So the fact that we started talking about this clear back in summer, we were able to let employees know, hey, if you're immunized, and you don't know where your records are, now would be a good time to find them so that if you are exposed, you've got that ready to show the health department or to show the nurse so that you don't have to be out for that time period. Okay. That's what I mean.
Got it. Yeah. All right. Card. Exactly.
Yeah. We had people that were, you know, said, well, I know it's in a box in a storage unit somewhere in the back probably. And so I like I said earlier, I appreciate that we were able to start communicating early so that people could find that information and have it ready.
All right. So is it anybody in the district without the vaccination record or just the elementary school that would be quarantined?
Well, the case came from the elementary, so that's where the exposure would be.
Mm. Okay. However, staff could have been, you know, exposed and then walked into the district office for a meeting or something, or no?
Well, the exposure is to the case itself. So if you were to play that out very far, all of a sudden, they could have walked into the local grocery store also. So someone who's exposed has just been exposed. It doesn't mean that they actually have the measles or would test positive for the measles. So the secondary and tertiary exposures really aren't something you can look at. You've got to look at the actual exposure to the known case.
Okay. And now that we've got about 20 students quarantined, how do they stay on top of their schoolwork between now and January 26 when the quarantine ends?
Right. Well, thankfully, again, because we've been able to start planning for this, teachers had already prepared learning packets just right before. Just once we got word that there could be a case, the teachers jumped right on it and started creating learning packets. And then over the weekend, once we got word of the case, we were able to go and make the appropriate number of learning packets that had already been printed, you know, from their teachers, and to make sure that we could get those to students so they didn't get behind.
Probably a good memory for some of those teachers about the days of the pandemic. I mean, COVID, of course, provided us with a robust online teaching system. Is that in the works, or it's just kind of sending home a printed packet?
No, we're sending home the learning packets. During COVID, if you experienced trying to teach online and trying to teach in person at the same time, it's really not possible. It's not feasible. So, teachers are certainly willing and wanting to work with students and parents as much as we can to try to help keep the kids current, and prevent them from getting behind.
All right. And with staff, you would just bring in substitute teachers or a custodian or whomever. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. The district did a January 1st enrollment count. This is unusual, again, because the official count happens October 1st. So why was that done?
Well, best practice is to keep, you know, the board and the community apprised of where we're at, especially where South Summit, like almost every district in the state, is a declining enrollment district right now, and so it's something that we report back to the board.
Okay, it's not required. It was just best practices here then, and it looks like total enrollment dropped by about 30 students from last April. So any ideas why?
Well, we don't have a whole lot of families moving in. We do have growth, but a lot of those are either retired or second homes. It comes and goes in waves. You get a large class, and then you get some small class, and you get a large cohort, and then a small cohort. So But if you look at the trend, like most districts, we are declining enrollment, and you know, as you know, birth rates down and things like that. So the state, I think they anticipate that trend changing in about 10 years to where enrollment across the state will start an uptick again.
And for the first time in years, the Park City School District opened its schools again. Does that, do you think that's had any impact on South Summit?
I mean, it's possible. You know, being so close, you know, being neighbors, you always get some students going back and forth. We certainly have students from Park City School District that enroll in our schools, especially over the school, Silver Summit over in Silver Creek. And likewise, we have students that will leave South Summit and opt to go to Park City. That's just the nature of districts that whose boundaries touch each other.
All right. As part of the regular master planning update at the board meetings, there was a discussion of the 20-year facility plan, and it said possible bond timelines. So what are we bonding for?
Well, we're not bonding necessarily for anything right this moment. It is something that the board has talked about. It's been talked about for years and years, but we've contracted with MHTN, architectural firm. They're helping us with a 20-year plan and feasibility study right now. And so there have been conversations, there's been a working session, and they've talked about it in some of the board meetings, just about the potential to bond, and if so, when would the right time be? So it wasn't an action item, it was more of a discussion item, so that we, as district leadership, had an idea of what the board really wanted to do with as far as a timeline. So some people had mentioned, well, do we try to bond this year? Others said, we don't want to go fast just to go fast. Do we, there's a saying, sometimes you have to go slow to go fast. So, you know, do we wait a year or do we wait two? The real point last night was we're going to continue working on working with MHTN on that feasibility study and on that 20-year plan, and because it had been mentioned, you know, potentially bonding sooner rather than later, that was something we put on there to discuss, just so that we knew, just so that we had a solid idea of what is the board wanting, or what do they envision with respect to a time frame for bonding and doing it in this next election was not something that they wanted to try to shove down people's throats really quick. It's something we want to be really thoughtful about. It. We want to get a lot of input from stakeholders, because we're talking about a 20-year plan, not just bonding for an individual school or whatnot. So we feel like, and our board, I believe, feels like we want the community to have a solid idea of what a good 20-year master plan looks like.
Okay, so that tells me that you want a plan in front of you, and when is that expected to be done?
Well, we just recently started working with MHTN, and so we've actually been working on a survey for staff, for employees, and we're working on a survey for parents, and we'll be working on a survey of some sort, or, talking points and things for information nights, things like that. So that's back to why we asked that it be a discussion item last night, was if it was something that the board wanted to try to do sooner rather than later, well, then we've really got to get things going, because we don't want to sugarcoat. We don't want to just rush for the sake of bonding or building. So we're going to be able to take our time and really make sure we're getting as much feedback and input from our community members, our parents, you know, students, staff. And so really that's the plan. I'm hoping that we'll have some data. Last night we talked about having something either right before summer or shortly after summer. as far as, you know, data on feedback from different stakeholders, and then we would probably start at some point thereafter doing some community evenings.
Okay. You also listed a link for parents who may want to opt out of having their child participate in standardized testing. Is that a thing?
It's a thing, and it happens. It's not that uncommon. Really, what we did is our old procedure was just a form that they filled out, and it had become an outdated form, and so we updated the form and we got rid of the actual form on the website as the procedure and put the link so that anytime a parent clicks on that link, it takes them to the updated opt-out form.
Okay. And parents, I guess, why do they want their kids opt out? I mean, what are the reasons for that?
Some parents just morally disagree or ethically disagree with high-stakes testing. Others, they can have any number of reasons. Some of them do it because their kids don't want to have to, take the test. It's not something that shows up on their grade. And so some kids don't want to take it and their parents will opt them out. There's any number of reasons that a parent may opt out of that, but some of them are just, they don't believe in the standardized tests.
All right. The board was also set to adopt a reduction in force policy. And I guess, are you thinking about with a reduced enrollment that you need to let go of some staff?
No, here's the thing about a reduction in force policy. Anytime a district, districts have done a reduction in force for decades, including in South Summit. Anytime someone leaves and you don't replace that position, you can consider that a reduction in force. And a lot of districts have policies already in place. The nice thing about having the policies, it's transparency for people who are going to be affected. So do we anticipate having to use it? Well, yes and no. We don't know what we're going to be faced with in the future, but we feel like it's important for employees to know the process that takes place in a reduction in force. And so, it really is there to help people know what guides us in that process.
Okay, Greg, anything else?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it was a good board meeting and encourage people to listen to it if they're interested.
Okay, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, take care. Bye-bye.
That's the superintendent of South Summit School District, Greg Mon. In the studio now with an update from the People's Health Clinic, I have CEO Maury Lining, along with Patient Access Director Patty Garcia. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Maury, maybe just start by reminding us of the People's Health Clinic purpose. I mean, what you do and what a difference the organization makes.
Yeah, first of all, thanks again for having us here. Happy 2026. When people think about Park City, they usually picture a wealthy ski town. What they don't think about are the thousands of people who work multiple jobs to keep our tourism economy running, and they don't have health insurance. So the People's Health Clinic exists really to close this gap. We provide high-quality health care to uninsured individuals and families in Summit and Wasatch counties so people can access care early, stay healthier, and avoid preventable emergencies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so anybody without insurance from Summit or Wasatch County eligible to show up. And how is it that you verify that they're not insured? I mean, or is that done? You just take them?
Exactly. If you're uninsured and you live in Summit or Wasatch County, you can come to our clinic. Our patient intake specialists actually do verify residency status.
Okay, how are you?
Residency status in the county, I should say.
Yeah, and the fact that you're not on any insurance payment plan. Yeah, okay.
Correct.
And how is it that you're funded? How do you do all this work?
We are funded privately. So we are a zero revenue clinic, meaning we do not bill for any services. Care is entirely free to our patient population. And we rely on the generosity of our exceptional community members. So fundraising is huge for us. It makes our services possible.
That's interesting because I think you used to charge like a meager, like a $10 copay or something, but nothing at all now, huh?
We've never required a payment. We do ask for a suggested donation, and a lot of our patients like to contribute. In fact, we usually receive about $130,000 to $150,000 a year in total of patient donations, but it's optional. It's not obligatory.
Now, if these uninsured folks just showed up at the emergency department, I mean, what would that mean then for the rest of us who do have insurance?
Well, I mean, when an uninsured individual shows up in the emergency department, and let's say they get the very basic level of intervention in the emergency department, that's at least a $2,000 cost to the individual. And, you know, also cost to the healthcare system. And so what we are able to do, and we're about $118 per visit per patient, is save the healthcare system at large a tremendous amount of money, but also make sure that patients are able to access care, which is a basic human right, without facing in bankruptcy.
Okay, so you're saying, I mean, for anybody to show up at the emergency department, it's minimum of $2,000, huh?
Correct, yeah. And that's where if you're insured, you know, you might have a copay, but if you're uninsured, and then that's a minimum visit, if you actually are, you know, having an intervention that requires a higher level of care, like helicopter transfer to downtown Salt Lake with an acute stroke, I mean, you're looking at tens of thousands of dollars.
All right. You're proud, though. I mean, for $118 a patient, that's pretty impressive. And maybe just tell us a little bit about some of the other outcomes that People's Health Clinic is providing our community, right?
Yeah, we are really proud of our healthcare outcomes. As a free clinic, our outcomes exceed most national benchmarks. So, for example, in our diabetes program, over 90% of our patients receive both a diabetic foot exam and an eye exam. And nationally, those numbers are below 50%. In fact, they are far lower for people who identify as Latino or Latina. And these exams prevent amputations, they prevent vision loss. This is prevention that truly changes lives. And the fact that we're able to achieve these really high healthcare outcomes as a free clinic is a lot in part due to our special sauce, which I would say is our community health case management team. And I'm so happy today that we have Patty Garcia, our patient access director, in the studio. She is an extraordinary stakeholder in the community in terms of connecting our patients to necessary healthcare services. And Patty, I'll let you take it away.
Okay, I was just going to say, what is it that you're responsible for there at the clinic, Patty?
Yeah, so we have five community health managers that help our patients. So our community health managers serve as trusted navigators and advocates for our patients who face complex barriers to access care. All of our patients are uninsured, so part of them, a big number of them, are mixed status families and working multiple jobs. So making the healthcare system difficult which makes the healthcare system difficult for them to navigate. So our community health managers help us help our patients apply for Medicaid and financial assistance for any services that they need outside of the clinic. Also help access medication patient assistance programs, which is the access to medications, free medications for our patients, which we in 2025 almost contributed to $3.8 million of free medications for our diabetic, big number of our diabetic patients. And we did over 2,000 applications in 2025 for free medication programs. So we do everything from referrals, specialty care. We connect our patients to any services needed outside of the clinic, and also do transportation. So our big number for each month is over 100 rides that we manage for our patients to either get to our clinic or any specialty clinic outside of the and anything outside of the clinic that it's needed, radiology, maternal fetal medicine, any specialty.
Yeah. So this nearly $4 million in medication. So who's paying for that?
So it's usually programs that are that are given to patients through patient assistance programs through every manufacturer. So it could be Merck.
Novo Nordisk
or a lot of our patients.
Yeah,
so they have access to insulin, very good medications for any chronic disease that they have.
Yeah, and I guess does the patient population at the health clinics follow the population of the rest of folks, right, just in terms of medical need? Diabetes, again, being probably top of the list, heart issues.
Exactly. I mean, the chronic diseases that we see in the United States, but even more so at the clinic, because really something like diabetes is a disease of poverty. It's exacerbated by not having money to afford healthy food, the leisure time to exercise, getting in early for screening due to limited healthcare access. Those are all barriers that we're trying to tackle.
Mari, as you know, Congress still arguing about whether to fund the ACA subsidies, and I certainly know of young people who have opted out of having insurance, and they're the ones that have really kind of made this program work financially because they have fewer health issues. So what are you anticipating?
Yeah, well, as you know, last week on the 8th, Congress actually passed a bipartisan bill in support of continuing these tax credits, essentially discounted access to health insurance for millions of people. But this needs to go to the Senate, and it's highly anticipated that the tax credits will be discontinued. As a result, we're expecting thousands of people in the community to not be able to afford health insurance, and we anticipate they'll come to us. Just in 2025 alone, and this is, pre-expiration of the ACA subsidies, we had about a 16% increase in patient encounters. And so in 2026, thinking about that growth plus, who we may get from dropping off of health insurance, we're thinking we'll probably have an additional 1,000 individuals come to us.
Wow. And can we... I mean, I guess do the math for me then. Are we talking about 1,000 times $120 or a lot more than that? Because that's just the 118 is just per visit. Is that what you're...
It is, although that 118 is really the cost of all of our services, excluding administrative costs, which for us are very low. We run a really efficient system because we're not tied up with insurance companies. So I don't have to have a billing department. I don't have a claims department. I have bare minimum in administration, which we all wear several hats. And then really, if you're donating to People's Health Clinic, $8 out of $10 are going directly to patient care.
All right. So what are you anticipating in terms of adding that 1,000 additional patients? I mean, what are you going to need to fundraise for?
Really, what we need is space. I mean, we need to fundraise for the cost of these individuals, absolutely. But our largest rate-limiting factor right now is we are physically out of space. With that being said, we're extremely grateful for our partnership with Summit County and the Summit County Health Department. They've promised us some extra space in the building beginning in May when they move several of their services to the to-be-named Skull Candy building. And that is... so timely. In fact, looking forward in 2026, and as we talked about in November, Leslie, we're expecting a surge of uninsured pediatric patients this year, unfortunately, because it's kids primarily who will lose out with the discontinuation of the ACA tax subsidies. And we have found a fantastic local pediatrician who's going to join us in April. Now it's just a matter of physically where we can put her in our clinic to get those children served.
Yeah. And you had received a grant for this to expand hours. Does that get cut back?
No, that goes back to our Mackenzie Scott grant that we were awarded in 2024 of $1 million. And strategically, with my board's help, we have allocated that over 3 years. And so we have another year of cost coverage for those extended hours. But, if you're asking what keeps me up at night, it is absolutely fundraising. We have incredibly talented staff. We have an integrated care model that works beautifully. We have providers who want to help us. You know, we have 35 volunteer providers and actually a waiting list of volunteer providers who want to come help us, but we don't have clinic room for them currently. So really it's about space and about having the funding to practice really smart healthcare, which is what we do.
Okay, well, the topic of the week has been, of course, measles. Is that something the clinic provides?
We do have a vaccination for children's program, so we absolutely do administer measles vaccinations. You know, at our clinic, we really do not have vaccine hesitancy. Many of our patients are immigrants, and they come from developing countries where they've seen these diseases in their lifetimes, and they understand the profound ramifications of not getting vaccinated. So our patients are thrilled at the opportunity to be vaccinated, and we do everything we can to make sure it's timely and accessible.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Mari, Patty, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie.